This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello and a very good afternoon to you. Today we'll spend some time just off the south coast of the state where parents from the tiny community of Munglinup, about 100 k's west of Esperance, are going to be in Perth this weekend, and they're going to be here to lobby for increased permanent school housing for their town. That's been on the agenda for, well, around about 10 years now, and they're really hoping for a breakthrough. And at the other end of the state, we'll head to the Kimberley, where the annual Fitzroy Crossing Bull Sale is on. I think things are just wrapping up at the sale, so we'll try and get you the top price shortly here on the Country Hour. This is the ABC right across Western Australia, 12:06. We start today in the state's southwest, where technology is taking over at one of Australia's largest avocado packing sheds, with robots soon to replace half the workforce and double the output capacity. Craig Boyce is the general manager of the Avocado Collective at Manjimup, about 290 kilometres south of Perth. He says the company has invested $17 million into automation because, firstly, it's difficult to find workers, and second, when you do, you're faced with the rising cost of labour. He says the move towards automation signals a structural shift in the industry.
Okay, what we're seeing is a step change in avocado packing in Australia, where we've automated 75% of the shed, and that allows us to obviously reduce staff numbers considerably, which is an increasing cost.
What are we looking at?
At the moment, we're looking at robots out of Japan, ABB robots, that stack the fruit, put it onto skews, onto pallets, send it away to a scanner automatically without anyone touching the fruit.
What's the advantage of having robots like these?
Well, they do turn up to work every day. They don't complain about a sore back. There's no health and safety issues. And, you can load them up. And you know their performance levels, and you can work them to that.
How much did it cost?
There's a $17 million investment being put in here. We've renovated the shed from the end of last season. Everything in here is new. There's $70 million worth of investment that needs a ROI on it now to, you know, throughput to make it happen. So, fortunately, we have a strong supply base. And because of that, this is just logic that we've done, nothing else.
How do you monitor it? Like, is there someone sitting in a control room just watching to make sure it all goes?
Two forms of monitoring. One is, yes, there's a control room that'll give us delivery of product. But then we also have KPIs for each part of the business, what we should be receiving onto a robot, what we should be going past a labelling machine, what staff members should be handling. It's so easy to model when you have collected the data from years before and you understand the performance of people, performance of robots, performance of machinery. So there's two levels. One is definitely a functional level of delivery of product to people, and the other one is, did we achieve the goals we should do? And that is live. That measurement's alive. If you can see in here, we have 360-degree cameras through the place. We can understand where fruit flows are moving through conveyor belts. We can see issues, we can highlight a fault that needs to be picked up by a maintenance person as it occurs. So there's a lot of thought, not only just to performance today, but for performance for the future.
How many workers does this replace?
We're at least half our workforce, at least half the workforce, and we'd obviously look for targets slightly better than that, but realistically we're taking everyone who hand stacks, everyone who scans fruit, and everyone who drives around on forklifts that aren't needed anymore. So it's quite easy to knock that number on the head. In the early days, we still have not automated our tray packing yet, but we have allowed in the shed room to automate tray packing.
Okay, so this is basically the pallet stacking, is that right?
That's correct. So this is a major part. You put in the trays, how you get it away, get it on the right pallets and get it right to into the core room efficiently, and the robots sit in the middle of that.
And so is it working now? How long have you been using it for?
Some of these robots we've had for 2 years, so we've now got 9 robots in here. Some of them are new this season, but they've all been working already this season.
So how many workers are we talking that you've managed to replace?
probably in a realm of somewhere between 40 and 50 staff. That'll be a number. Most of them are overseas staff, backpackers. We have a very strong local team, and all those are with us and will stay with us through this whole evolution. They're all very keen and very passionate about the change as well. A lot of them have had to think about their job specs a bit and what they used to do versus what they can do today. But every one of them is up for the challenge and invested in this project.
And do you use AI to manage this at all?
I mean, AI is just a whole lot of data that needs to be collected. So I think we're 1 year away from that, collecting that data or having enough resourcing. We use AI on the grading equipment for the specifications and the changes that we do there. But it was a very good product out of WA, the avocado. It's a very clean product. And so AI is not as relevant there as it is around staff movements, efficiency. So we have the ability to track people. We have the ability to track boxes. We have the ability to track any piece of any tool in the place. So AI is the next step in this evolution to get performance.
How's the season looking for the consumer?
WA is on an off year, had a massive crop last year, and they tend to go into an off season. So yes, we're definitely on a lighter season. That's going to allow us to bed all this process in for a very heavy season the year following. But you know, in the day, this is scalable, this machinery. The cost is a fixed cost, but the number of people you need versus the crop you need is quite scalable. So we can run a light crop and we can run a very heavy crop.
Is anyone else in Australia using robots like those?
There's a few of these robots around for sure, but no one's committed to all the integration. And even overseas, a lot of people are not committed to all the integration. So this is a end-to-end integration. So it's different. I've been to quite a few sheds and I haven't seen anything like this.
Could this replace workers totally?
You'll never replace everyone because you still need a level of management and maintenance and that sort of thing. But obviously the cost of labour is a ever-increasing phenomena. Where we would like to get to is a low number of key staff working in a shed with robotics. That would be good, but this is a local business and it's owned by local people, and supporting local economy is important, and we, you know, our key staff are local, and so you know, our growers are local, so there's a whole social side of thinking about how that might fit or might not fit, and that's not a discussion we've thought about engineering at this point in time. You could, of course, you can go to lights out packing and that sort of thing, but fundamentally, we are a collective of growers who supply us, that we service, and we like to think we've got a strong social connection with that supply base.
Craig Boyce, he's the general manager of the Avocado Collective based in Manjimup. He was speaking to George Aloney at the launch of the collective's $17 million new robotic and automation systems that they've installed into Australia's largest avocado packing shed. 13 past 12. Artificial intelligence, or AI, is also being put to work in the grains industry. A South Australian-based company has designed and built a system that uses AI to grade and assess grain quality, which ultimately determines what growers are paid for their grain. Co-founder and CEO of Cropify's Opal system, Anna Faulkner, says the tech is fast, unbiased and objective.
Grain grading, as your audience is probably very aware, currently is performed by humans. And of course, humans all have different levels of experience and expertise in grading. So there's a lot of variance in the grade that growers may receive for a parcel of grain. So that's the major challenge we're trying to solve, is come up with an objective test that removes the subjectivity of human knowledge from the testing environment. But also the benefit of that is we realised we had to make sure it was fast and efficient as well. So from that, our testing regime is not only objective, so it doesn't have any bias, but also it's a consistent testing time. So it takes somewhere between 2.5 and 5.5 minutes consistently to perform the grading test with our technology, whereas a human can be anywhere from 10 minutes to 30 minutes, depending on the season. So it really delivers that objective, unbiased solution, and that's what we're trying to solve. But also the benefit to that is then we've baked in the efficiency.
So this is using, I understand, artificial intelligence. Just as how does this process work and how does it compare to the traditional method of grading?
Yeah, sure. So you know, traditionally there's a human in the sample stand. They'll go out and get a probe a sample out of the back of the truck, and that's a representative sample. So they still do that process, but once they get into the classy hut, back into the sample stand, they screen the sample as they would according to Grain Trade Australia's standards, but then the process differs. Instead of the human going through the sample and visually looking for defects and weed seeds and picking them out and weighing each individual defect and weed seed by count, they load our patented trays and place that sample in our what we call Cropify Opal and follow the instructions on the touchscreen. And that takes, as I said, with the screening and to the time the results come down, that takes maximum of 5.5 minutes for that process. Whereas doing it by hand, they could be there, as I said, for up to 30 minutes. And we've built our hardware so it fits nicely on the bench where the grading occurs currently in the grading stand.
You mentioned there before about taking the subjectivity out of it. Is it as accurate as a human grading system?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So that was a big piece of work on for our team. We had to say, right, well, how accurate or how harsh do we want to be? We want to make sure we're in line with professional full-time graders that work at a bulk handler. So we don't want to be harder. We want to make sure that we're in a band where we know we're as good as the professional full-time graders. So that is what we've aimed to do, because we could have aimed for a much higher mark, but we don't want to. Obviously, we want to make sure we're equitable and fair and we are in line with those professional full-time graders, because that is basically what we're benchmarking against.
Is there still a component of human oversight in this process?
Yeah, it certainly is. You could describe Cropify Opal as a co-pilot almost. That term's been taken by multinational, so we won't use that. But you still need a human to operate the machine and to screen the sample. And then when you get to the results screen, when the results appear on our user interface screen, the user can go through the categories and actually look at the images. Because obviously in Australia, we grade farm address. So it's direct from the paddock. It's usually got, you know, weed seeds and other material in it, where in overseas territories, they grade based on a screen sample. So those weed seeds are predominantly removed. So we've had to train our product to recognise a vast amount of weed seeds and foreign material and bits and pieces. So we're very, very good at it. But if something very obscure appears in a sample, it may be even a man-made piece of material, we may not have trained our software to recognise that. So we allow a bit of human intervention on the last screen just to look at those categories that may have foreign material. You can have a look at the foreign material and just see what's appeared in there. But we're very, very accurate and great at the majority of the main weed seeds found in each growing region.
And what type of crops have you been able to successfully utilise it for?
Yeah, so we commercialised last year, and being very proudly South Australian, we have started with red lentils. Red lentils are primarily a South Australian and Wimmera growing region crop, and growing in popularity as a break crop with growers. So we started with lentils. We thought it would be the hardest for us to train for, and it was laborious, but we're very, very good at that now. And now we are launching our Desi chickpea model for New South Wales, Southern Queensland as well. So they're the two crops we have available for this coming harvest.
You've had some uptake by an acceptance by the industry, so it will be utilised by this harvest?
Oh, we were being utilised by paying customers last harvest. We were in the Wimmera last harvest, and harvest went extremely well for us, and those customers are all coming back on again. And we've just announced that we were the first of our kind product to be endorsed by Grain Trade Australia by the Standards Committee, which is, we're very proud of that. It was a very long process, took us 18 months of benchmarking, peer review by the industry and doing lots of trials to make sure the industry was happy with our product and confirmed that we're a credible solution to be used in the grain supply chain.
Cropify co-founder and CEO Anna Falconer speaking to Selena Green. 20 past 12. The Rural Supplies and Agricultural Services Company, Elders, has also launched a new AI-powered wheat condition report. It's a monthly national assessment of wheat crop conditions, and it's designed to help Australian growers make more informed decisions throughout the growing season. The report's been developed in partnership with OctopusBot and provides a regional, state and national view of crop conditions using advanced data modelling, artificial intelligence, localised weather information and high-resolution satellite imagery. The report will be published monthly right through until November, with plans to continually improve and refine its contents. If you want more details about it, just head to the Elders website, but we might have a talk about it in some more detail on Monday's Country Hour. 21 past 12. Well, artificial intelligence consultant Julian Moore says as farmers become more familiar and more confident with the technology, it's going to adapt to your needs. And you'll actually wonder what you ever did without it. Julian was a guest speaker at this week's Women in Farming Conference held at Kojonup, 265 kilometres southeast of Perth. He says the starting point for using AI is turning its intelligence into something that's useful for each individual.
Intelligence is what you need to have something become useful. Intelligence itself doesn't actually make it useful. What we have to do is apply that intelligence in an intelligent way, if that makes sense. So effectively, let's say we have an old machine on the farm and we want to understand how to repair the alternator. Just raw intelligence won't tell you in a way that you might understand. It might use far too much engineering terms for a non-engineer. So what we actually have to do is take the intelligence and make it useful in the way people understand it.
How do you go about doing that?
Well, what we do is, first off, you work out who's using it. So let's say it's a 65-year-old male farmer who's never been anything other than on the machine. Well, his technical levels can be quite low. So essentially, the easiest way in that aspect is to have them talk to AI. So if they can make it a voice application where they can say, I'm looking at this because the camera's on, can you tell me how to change the alternator? Well, in the background, the AI should now understand who it's working with, their technical abilities and levels. Then it should understand how they talk and what they mean by the way they talk. And then essentially, that will go off. It will find the information about the machine because it's got visual recognition. Then it'll find the, the manual for it. And then it'll change it into a language that the person who's going to be doing the repairing can understand.
So really, AI technology is applicable for any skill level, provided you understand how to use it.
Well, providing that it knows you. The key is that AI is crazy intelligent now. Like, if we turn it off today and just say, this is it forever, it takes over 4 years for us just to work out what we've got at the moment. So with that information, it really means as long as it knows who you are and what you do, it will adapt itself behind it.
How would you describe the adoption of AI in Australian agriculture?
This is really interesting because I had to do a white paper on this just recently. So if you break agriculture down and aquaculture separately, aquaculture's got a 2% take-up, whereas agriculture's got about a 16% take-up. And now you put that against the national benchmark, and even the highest ones, which are accounting firms and insurance companies, they're a 24% take-up. So actually, agriculture's doing exceptionally well. I think the agriculture's been starved of investment for donkey's years, and everyone is infinitely practical. And so the moment you can see a $28 tool that can do X, Y, and Z, and I can now have it useful in these areas, they try it. They don't care if it won't work first time, they try it. So I think the very nature of ag being practical and cash-strapped means that they're innovative. And in my mind, the dark horse of AI, they're doing some of the most innovative things.
Can you give me one standout example of a way you've seen an ag business use AI usefully?
Yeah, my favourite is the facial recognition of sheep. Now in lambing season, if you put them all into a paddock and stick a pole up with a $200 Sony camera, that's now a Wi-Fi camera. So you turn on your laptop, connect it to the camera and run something like GPT or Claude. It will now identify every animal in that paddock via their face. So facial recognition in sheep's not illegal. So of course, then when they have a lamb, it matches the lamb across to the ewe and will remember whose lamb belongs to who. But then it will also record weight, condition, measurement, and everything in between just for a $200 camera.
The use of video is really interesting because it's that notion of if you can see something, you can count something, therefore you can measure it, you can grade it, and you can boost productivity just with that simple tool. How have you seen video glasses used in the field?
Video glasses are one of these odd technologies. Like, take it from me, never wear them out in the street. You just look creepy. They're a business tool. And as a business tool, imagine anything you can see, the AI can see. Let's start with the fact they're $200, and immediately you take off the AI that's on them and you put your own AI on, whatever you're using, GPT, Claude, whatever. Now, your 200 staff, you can now locate them via GPS so you know where they are and what part they're meant to be at. You can live stream, so if there's an issue with an animal, they can simply, rather than take their phone out, they can touch the corner of the glasses, it will call you, and then live stream, and you can see what they're seeing. And so in the case of a sick animal, you can have the vet patch in and view the animal live as it's happening without waiting for them to turn up. It's just speed of response. I really like the glasses. They're used in so many industries, but they're a business tool. They don't look cool.
And I guess that reluctance to lean into those sorts of workflow tools is that risk of AI bots training off your business data. What other tips do you have around that?
So always use the business accounts and use GPT business, Anthropic business, Microsoft business. Doesn't matter which AI you use, you must use the business account. That gives you your compliance, safety, non-training side of things. The other thing is most of the concerns about security were relevant 2 years ago. Today, the market's matured and they're very, very mindful of security. So for what we're doing, we're not a hospital, we're not government, we're running small business. And with that in mind, it's very well set up to be really useful and secure. It's more secure than your current Outlook email. Like, because it's AI encrypted at the front end, at transfer and at rest, whereas your email isn't.
How is AI technology in agriculture forecasted to expand? What's next?
Agriculture is fast. Like, it's fast, fast. We're already seeing fertilizers spread in higher doses where required and no dose where it's not required. We're already seeing hydrology mapping linked to the sprayers, so we know this solution. Bring in drones to that, bring in self-driving to that, and you've really got a techno farm. And I think what we're very quickly going to see is labor force get affected because humanoid robots are here this year. So because they're here this year, if you need more fruit pickers or seasonal staff and you don't get the numbers you're expecting, whether there's a flood that locked you off or whatever it may be, you'll have a robot force there that, you know, at $20,000 a pop, you can have a few of those sat in the wings waiting to help you do the job.
That's my next question, is the impact of this robotic technology on human resources, on farms, within factories, pack houses, etc. Surely there's still space for human skill.
In agriculture, I'm going to agree with you. Yeah, absolutely. In agriculture, we're a skilled industry. Agriculture is decades of generations of families refining the perfect way to farm, and that can't be replicated. That's, you know, that's why we use tools, but still have the oldest bloody bloke in the thing, because they're the ones with the most knowledge and we pass it down. That piece, I'll agree, like, absolutely, there's a lot of space there to bring robots in without any detrimental effect. Warehouses, I think they're going to get decimated. If I've got a robot that is either $400 a month and it can lift and shift, and that person's job is to lift and shift, they're not going to want $400 a month. They're literally, the cost of labor is already been replaced. So I think warehouses are in extreme risk, and I think that will happen by the end of next year.
I don't know whether to be really excited or terrified by the AI and how well it's going to get to know me over the years and anticipate every move or thought. Be part of the conversation if you'd like to on the text 0448 922 604. Peter says, increase number of examples of innovative AI, regular references to usefulness, but never seems to be any mention of reduction of actual costs and fees to producers. The text 0448 922 604. It is 29 to 1, and Jonathan Hopper is here. He's got the news headlines for you. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Indonesian police are investigating the death of a Perth man after he was allegedly assaulted in Bali. Regional police say the man was allegedly assaulted more than 2 weeks ago at a bar in Kuta. His family alleges the father of four was brutally assaulted by a group of Australians who are yet to be identified. The peak body representing parents of WA public school students is set to consider a motion calling for two staff members in every classroom. The motion will be discussed at the Western Australian Council of State School Organisations conference this weekend. And a lawyer representing two women involved in the Sydney Swan scandal says his clients intend to seek damages for pain and suffering following the incident. Several adult entertainers are understood to have joined players at a hotel on Sunday night. Police are investigating an alleged sexual assault at the hotel, which the ABC understands centres on a player allegedly touching one of the women without her consent. No charges have been laid. Thank you, Belinda.
Thank you so much for the update, Jonathan. Appreciate that. It is 28 to 1.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Still to come, we will catch up with one of the farmers from the Great Southern who recently went on the Kokoda Track in Papua New Guinea with a few other farmers from around that Kulin area. We'll also cross to Fitzroy Crossing, get the latest from the bull sale today, the 20th annual Fitzroy Crossing bull sale. And then Danny Burkett along just before the news at 1, going through the wool market details for you. There has been a 3-week recess of sales, but it's all back to business this week. Danny with those details just before the news at 1. Let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology. Catherine Shelfout is here today. What's the story across northern and eastern parts, Catherine?
Good afternoon, Belinda. Most of the activity is through central WA today. We've got a cloud band lying through those parts. So I've seen Carnarvon's had some reasonable rainfall the last couple of days, but it looks like on the radar that rainfall is now moving a little bit further south over Shark Bay today. And we'll expect to see some of that extending in through inland parts of the Gascoyne and also some patchy rainfall through the interior today as well. Chance of a thunderstorm today from the far western Pilbara through the Gascoyne, and I'll talk about central west later. So ranging sort of from just a couple of millimetres at the edges of that cloud band up to about 25 millimetres possible closer to the Gascoyne coast. And then over the next couple of days, we'll see that cloud band moving east through tomorrow and Sunday and taking the rain and thunderstorms with it. So focusing on the southern Gascoyne, northern Goldfields and interior tomorrow, and then further east, mainly through the northern Goldfields and the interior on Sunday. So Sunday does look like it's got the potential for some more intense storms and heavier rainfall, but as I mentioned, that's mostly through eastern parts of the state where we have less population. And just for the remainder, the Kimberley and the Pilbara are pretty quiet, mostly sunny, just light to moderate southeasterly winds today, and we'll see a southwesterly change pushing through the Pilbara on the weekend.
And how's it looking across the Southwest Land Division?
So, yeah, we did have some fog and low cloud around this morning, but pretty sunny through most parts at the moment, except for closer to the south coast. Warmish day and just light easterly winds, and that's due to the weak ridge sitting along the south coast. We've also got a weak trough forming near the west coast, so that's very much a spring pattern. And we might see a few, I mentioned the thunderstorms through the Gascoyne, so we might also see some just pushing down through inland parts of the central west this afternoon, so mostly around Mullawar, so yeah, northern parts of the central west. Tomorrow we'll see the ridge along the south coast moving east and the trough near the west coast pushing a little bit further down along the west coast there. So still some moisture around through southern districts in the morning, so we've got a chance of fog through the southwest, the Great Southern and southern coastal districts. And for the rest of the Southwest Land Division, a sunny morning, winds light north-northeasterly. So with that northerly flow, we'll see warm air pushing right down to the south coast. We're going for 26 at Hopetown tomorrow, 23 for Esperance. But we do expect to see some showers and thunderstorms again developing on and east of the trough. And with the trough being further south, we should now see them pushing down. So along the west coast from Geraldton, sort of as far south as Perth, and then inland north of about Narrogin to Southern Cross. So, and some showers as well as, so that first area was the thunderstorms and maybe some showers pushing a little bit further south than that as well. Rainfall will be patchy, so if you happen to be under a thunderstorm, you could get up to 15 millimetres. So there is the potential there for some of the northern parts of the growing areas, but more broadly sort of 1 to 8 millimetres, so will be very variable. But by midnight tomorrow, that trough pretty much has weakened and moved inland. Sunday, Monday, pretty quiet, weak ridge over the west coast, light to moderate south-southwesterly winds on Sunday, becoming light and variable on Monday. There's a really weak cold front comes through Sunday morning, but any showers I think will be pretty close to the coast and less than a few millimetres. And we do have a cold morning on Monday, so temperatures dropping down to 0 to 3 degrees, mainly through the Great Southern and the Southern Wheat Belt. So Monday morning there is a chance of frost. And then finally for Tuesday, that ridge will be pushed north and east by an approaching cold front. So Tuesday will be another cold morning, but seeing that frost risk just a little further north, so north of about Narrogin to Lake Grace and up as far perhaps as Muckambooden. Northwesterly winds ahead of the front, not very strong winds though, and the front crossing the southwest corner Tuesday morning. It's quite slow moving. And then we get a bit of variability. So the Australian model only suggesting a couple of, well, 6 to 15 millimetres through the southwest corner and only 1 or 2 millimetres getting into growing areas. But the European model does intensify that front a bit later on Tuesday into Wednesday. So it would suggest that we get a little bit more extensive rainfall coming through on Wednesday through the agricultural areas. So we'll keep an eye on that and be able to tell you a bit more on Monday.
Thank you for that, Catherine. Appreciate it. 22 to 1. Let's take a look now at the rainfall that's fallen across the state with Richard Hudson.
And it's a similar story to yesterday. The only region to get any real rain was the Gascoyne. Carnarvon had 13 mils, Gascoyne Junction and Mingar Springs 10, Steep Point and Tangadee 5, and Three Rivers had 7, and that's it. But, Bell, back in 2002, I was fortunate enough to be able to walk the Kokoda Track in Papua New Guinea with a few mates, and some of them were farmers in the Kulin area. One is still farming. That was for the 60th anniversary of the famous battles between Aussie and Japanese soldiers on the track during the Second World War. Well, earlier this year, some farmers from a bit further south from there in the Noongarup Shire decided to train up for the challenge as well. Ongarup farmer Jai Duggan was part of that group, and they've just completed it. He says it was a great opportunity to get off the farm and do something memorable with his mates whilst learning a fair bit about what those soldiers endured in that gruelling four-month campaign back in 1942.
We had a dry track and we didn't have any rainfall on the trail, so it's still physically fairly tough, but if you were to go in the wet season, yeah, it'd be really tough. We went on the 18th of July. The trek itself was 8 days. So I think the whole trail was close to 100 kilometres. I think there was a bit over 6 kilometres up and down. First and the last day were only kind of a few days trekking, but I think like kind of in the middle we were doing 20 kilometres a day. Yeah, you'd start probably on the trail at 6 a.m. And the longest day was probably about 5:30 p.m. we got in.
And did you have people carrying your packs along the way, Jai, or was it kind of you have to do everything yourself?
No, so they definitely encourage us to get a porter, the old Papa boys, or they, as they call them, the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels. But yeah, they could carry up to 12 kilos, which is mostly, you know, your clothes and your sleeping gear, where we had our own day packs, which you might carry 3 or 4 litres of water, a handful of snacks, and just a couple of basic things to get you through the day.
And what do you reckon the hardest day was? Was there one that comes to mind?
I think it was around day 5. We went up Brigade Hill, and that just seemed to never end. Probably 5 hours of nearly kind of seemed like straight up. I'll have to have been probably 11 and a half hours that day, I think. So we're all pretty knackered by the time we got through that day.
Well, it was a group of farmers, I understand, that went along to do the track. Is that right?
Yes, yep. There was 10 of us in our group all up from our Ongrup area.
What made you guys want to do it in the first place?
Just one of the boys said in Feb that we should go and do something, challenge ourselves somewhere a bit. And then one of the boys just said, oh, always wanted to do Kokoda Trail, and I reckon within a few days someone had put up a trek that you could go on and the price, and we just all booked it. And then we kind of started looking into what we had to prepare for, which, we probably worked out we need to start training pretty quick. So we had four months training in the lead up.
How do you actually prepare for something like Kokoda when you're living and working on a farm, like not just trying to find the time, but I imagine there's not too many mountains handy for training near you?
No. The opposite. we've got the Stirling Ranges at our back doorstep, well, within 3/4 an hour from us. So we had plenty of, you know, get out there at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. and try and climb Bluff Knoll, or there's a heap of different treks you can do out there. So, yeah, we're trying to do that at least once a week, and then kind of at the end we're trying to get to kind of 3 days a week. Did some kind of, I think we were 20 to 30K treks along the coast as well, through sand dunes and along the beach, which wasn't my favourite, but I definitely preferred the mountains better.
So, Well, I was more meaning like when you're on the farm, are you having to train like every day there, you know, getting up and just going for a walk first, then getting into the day?
A couple of boys were nearly going for a jog every morning. Yeah, I didn't get that excited. So
because you're all footy boys as well, you're all playing for Boxwood.
Yeah. Quite a few of us are either ex-players or play for Boxwood. So still trying to play footy in the lead up. A few of us, most of us, probably dropped out kind of the last 3 or 4 weeks before, just trying to make sure we didn't get an injury before we went to Kokoda. So yeah, I think training and getting out there with your mates is probably is nearly one of the funnest parts of it, I think. The Stirling Ranges is absolutely amazing. Like, I've been there for 11 years and never even done something like as basic as Bluff Knoll. Yeah, there's heaps of trails up there. You know, it's definitely great for your mental health, being able to get out and about, and it just gives you another reason to get out of bed early every now and then and go and do something with your mates.
And there's so much history as well, Jai, that's associated with the track.
Yeah, we had a fantastic trek leader, so he was full bottle on all the history along the trail. We had a bit of family and my wife's grandfather in the war as well, so learned a hell of a lot about that on the way through. It's probably something that we never got taught at school, so didn't really know a lot of history before we went into it. We looked up a bit of history on it, but yeah, we learnt a heap on the trail, and it was amazing what the diggers had to go through out there. It's pretty much until you see it. It's pretty unbelievable what they did back in the day. But we did a dawn service at Isharava, got to stand up and say a few things. Our carriers, they sung the national anthem, pretty emotional. We don't normally get too emotional about things, but it was actually amazing to do. So.
Yeah, I can imagine so. So when you got home from being away, how'd the farm look? Was it pretty different from when you had left?
It was, yeah, we were hanging for a bit of rain before we left. So I think we left kind of around the 18th of July. The crops had grown a little bit. We were still spraying a bit of nitrogen and fungicide around. And when we got home, we soon realised that not put any more nitrogen on. The crops had probably stalled a bit. Yeah, started losing some tillers. And we've had pretty minimal rainfall since then. Like, we've probably only had 10 or 11 mil for August, and we only had 13 for July. So, you know, kind of looking at 25 mil for the last 8 weeks. So it's, yeah, really out of the ordinary for us for the middle of winter.
Where are you guys farming, and what have you got in this year?
So we're kind of, well, home farm South Needlup, but land from Ongrup to Gardner, wheat, barley, canola, got some oats and some lupins as well, and yeah, we also have quite a few sheep, so plenty of pasture that we seeded, but it's all still there. But I think we're back to realising that if we get average, we're going to be lucky. And yeah, we're definitely hanging out for a rain pretty soon. So
Yeah, well, I was just about to say, end of August, heading into spring.
Yeah, there's definitely nothing under the crop now. It's kind of starting to go backwards a fair bit, but yeah, fingers crossed we get something jump up that. So not forecast, because every time we look at the 10-day, it's saying rain in 10 days, that 10 days comes around and we're looking at the long range again, hoping for something else to pop up.
Ongerup farmer Jai Duggan speaking to Kate Forrester about a recent trip he took with some other farmers from that great southern region to complete the Kokoda track in Papua New Guinea. 14 to 1.
This week on Landline, restoring healthy waterways in southeast Queensland. Riverbanks are being repaired and hotels for freshwater cod introduced to encourage breeding.
You can't just put fish in water and they're going to live. We've got to address the reasons why the fish became extinct in the first place.
That's Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
And there's also going to be a story about waste featured on this Sunday's Landline. It features Western Australian researcher Lynn Liu, who's established herself as a waste merchant. And her business helps growers and producers recover value from agricultural waste and sub-grade produce for secondary markets and alternative uses.
I started out with abalone products, so you could use the viscera, which is, you know, the guts. You can use that for nutraceuticals. You could use it for pet food. With horticultural products, it's a little bit broader. You know, there's obviously food for human consumption, and then there's also the extraction of polyphenols and antioxidants, things like that. So nutraceutical and pharmaceutical use. But we're also seeing that just through fermentation, you can actually turn these products into, you know, obviously alcohol because of the high sugar content. But I'm also working with someone who can actually turn fruit waste into lab-grown wood, which is incredible, within 21 days. Just through precision fermentation, he's just extracting the pure cellulose and fibre. So it's pretty incredible the things that we can do with food.
UpWaste founder Lynn Liu, who's going to be part of that waste story on Sunday's Landline episode, 12:30 this Sunday. 12 minutes to 1 o'clock. We'll get the details on the wool market with Danny Burkett just before the news at 1. First, let's make our way to, well, just off the south coast of the state, where parents from the tiny community of Munglinup, 100 kilometres west of Esperance, are heading to Perth this weekend to lobby for increased permanent school housing for their town. The locals have been calling for a second grow house or government regional officer housing for almost a decade. Parent Matt Bell says at the moment there's a constant turnover of teachers, which isn't great for their kids' education.
So we did 3 transition days where she met her teacher and she absolutely loved it, was really excited to go. And on the first day of kindy this year, she says, I can't wait to see my teacher. And then we had to give her a different name. And then, so we got over that waterworks. And then in the first semester, we went through 4 teachers. And then her classroom now has another different one again. So we're, 5 teachers in 3 terms.
What does that do to the kids?
They're pretty resilient, but it's more we look at their their development. So a new teacher turns up and it takes them, you know, a couple of weeks to get comfortable, and then it takes the teacher a few weeks to assess what level they're at, and then we start the learning journey. So we're 4 weeks in before everyone really settles in and starts to develop on things.
How much of an issue does the instability of housing, how much do you think that plays?
Oh, it's huge. Absolutely huge. So we have teachers all the time that absolutely love it here. But when we tell them that there's no house in Mungalinup, so they can't walk to work or it's not a 5-minute drive, they say, why do that? Well, we can go to a bigger regional centre and, you know, they can be a 10-minute commute rather than a half hour, 40-minute one on a gravel road.
And live in the community. They want to be part of the community.
They want to be able to come down and have a beer at the rec centre after work on a Friday afternoon, not do that and then drive, you know, 40 k's down the highway.
So where are staff living at the moment?
So we've got one living in a short-term rental about 15 k's out of Mungalinup. There's another one living in the grow house at Jerdacutup, which is roughly 40 k's away. And then, ironically, we've actually got one living in the caravan park at the moment. So the grow house in Mungi technically is empty because it was to be set up as a transition house, but wheels of government turned slow and it wasn't ready in time for our teacher to arrive. So between the staff at the school and the parents, we're scrambling to get that house furnished now so that she can actually move into the grow house that we've got. It feels like bashing your head against a brick wall, but we can't give up because our kids deserve better than they're getting. It's got to a point where we'd be naive to think that there wasn't families constantly having that conversation. How long can we keep putting our kids through the constant change before we make the ultimate decision to either split up the family or move off the land? Their education is the most important gift we can give them at such a tender age, and you only get one shot at it.
Mungalinup parent Matt Bell, who's been fighting for a better solution to the teacher housing problem for a number of years now. And that situation is not unique. And that story by Tara de Landgraft is going to feature on tonight's ABC News on the TV from 7 o'clock, if you want to tune in. 8 minutes to 1.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Joining me for The World Today, with revelations that wealthy Christian sect The Brethren secretly paid far-right activists to perform stunts to disrupt the last federal election. Meanwhile, China is launching a mission to the moon to find ice. Court documents in the highly publicised battle for control of the Murdoch media empire have just been made public. And over in India, more than 1 million rickshaws in Delhi are to go electric. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
Very shortly, Danny Burkett along to go through the wool market details for you, sales here in the west and in the east. But first, let's head to the Kimberley, where the 20th annual Fitzroy Crossing bull sale has been underway today. 123 bulls were up for sale, and all of them have been trucked in from Queensland. That's a 3,000-kilometre road trip. Central Queensland cattle producer Steve Farmer has been a vendor at the sale for 17 years and says it's really grown from its humble beginnings 2 decades ago.
We have started off very, very basic. The original sale was actually held out on one of the local station in their home yards, and then it's grown as it come into the Fitzroy rodeo grounds here, and over the years we've built pens and built a selling ring, and a lot of physical work's been done over here. But yeah, the type of bulls that we've produced over the years have probably been fairly consistent in that you bring bulls suitable for the market over here. We've certainly had challenges over the years in just getting bulls here through COVID years and all the rest of it. It's never really been an easy feat getting them over here. But yeah, certainly the buyers have stuck by us, and probably the difference in this sale also is that the actual sale committee is pretty much made up of the actual buyers, more so than made up of vendors. So over the years, they sort of tell us the type of animals they want and what's important to them, and that's probably what's really made this sale work for all this time. Probably over the years, I guess the scene has changed a little bit over at this end, probably a lot more corporate operations over here these days compared to the original. There was probably a lot of more privately owned properties over here 20 years ago. But yeah, it's still a pretty good catch-up and a social occasion for a lot of those people that you've been to almost every sale in the last 20 years as well.
What's particular about this sale compared to the other sale, the other bull sales that you would attend throughout the year?
Probably really, you know, the bulls are specifically suited to this environment and bringing them over here. They're not a lot of sale preparation put into them. So they're, yeah, traditionally a little bit lighter, so they're ready to go straight out in the paddock and do their job. Certainly everything's semen and morphology tested. That was sort of something that came in probably well before a lot of sales in the east started using morphology testing. It was sort of the buyers over here were chasing that sort of stuff. Obviously a lot of higher percentage of polled animals, and yeah, very good sheath's always been an important factor over here as well. So bulls over here are generally very, very tidy in that area as well.
If you could predict how the sale would be evolving over the next couple of years, can you make any predictions for that?
Yeah, certainly data is, you know, more and more important for the buyers over here. There's more people looking at EBV data and fertility is very, very important to them also. So, yeah, and the balance of the different breeds or whatever else that, there's sort of certainly Droughtmaster's been strong, some Brahmins have been strong, we've got Charbros over here as well, and Red Brangus. So yeah, different stations all chase different breeds.
For this sale, how have your bulls travelled? How is it all looking?
Yeah, bulls have travelled really well. We've got 123 or 24 bulls over here. They've obviously done the full 4,500 kilometres over here, and yeah, there's no lame bulls, no nothing sore or anything like that. They just walked off the truck. As though they just got on the truck at the other end. So it's been the bulls look really, really good.
Yeah, and I imagine you're feeling pretty confident about the sale going into it.
Yeah, you never try and be overconfident at a sale, but. Yeah, you know, it's a pretty secure base over here, so I think it should be a pretty reasonable sale.
Well, the journey was even longer than I thought. 4,000 to 4,500 kilometre road trip from Queensland over to WA. Central Queensland Droughtmaster breeder Steve Farmer speaking to Jessica D'Souza. The sale has just finished, and we understand the top price was $13,000. A few of the bulls on offer were withdrawn ahead of time, but the remaining 120 were sold. The average price was just over $7,000, compared with around $5,300 last year. For all the details on the sale, tune in to Monday's Country Hour. We'll have it here for you. 3 minutes to one. In this week's wool sales, the Eastern Market Indicator was down 61 cents to close at 812 cents a kilo clean, and the Western Market Indicator is down 64 cents to finish the week on 1,988 cents a kilo clean. Danny Burkett, after a 3-week recess in sales, what do you make of this week's results?
Not a good start to the wool market in Australia. If we look at the Fremantle market, the fine end fell 60 to 70 clean, and the mediums are 75 to $1.10. 21's dropping a full $1.10. They closed below $20. So not a great start for the combing market. Pieces and bellies across the board followed suit. We could say the fine end 50 clean, the medium 70 clean. Oddments were a mixed bag this week. We had locks were up 50, stains and crutchings off 20. Lambs insufficient to quote at this stage. Longer lambs, those being the wiener lengths, sort of that 55 to 60 mil. They performed reasonably well in the open top market, but not a great start to the wool market overall. If you look at 18 micron, that closed at 23.75. 19 still above $22 at 22.10. 20 micron at $20.40, and as I said, 21's close at $19.90. So across the board, and that was replicated in the Sydney and Melbourne, and the market did fall a touch more on the second day as Fremantle only traded on the first day of the opening sale.
Were you surprised by the result this week, Danny?
Surprised, yes, I was a little, just given that the results around supply are still with us. As I said prior to the recess, the fundamentals are still in place, and that is supply. But I do think it's just a small anomaly. I would suggest that as we go on, there may have been a fair amount of currency driven in that. As it, I think the dollar was 71.5 when we opened. That was 1.5 cents higher than when we closed. The old adage in the wool market is worth 30 odd cents clean for every cent move. So I was a bit surprised. given the four, the largest of the four, in particular the mediums, medium-type merinos. But, yeah, surprised overall, yes.
All right. Well, we'll keep tabs over the next few weeks and see how things develop. But who was buying this week, Danny?
West Australian based Morris taking a huge chunk of the fleece wool, TNU also, and Sequoia there as well. Interesting, no tech wool in the top four of merino fleece wool, but they were large buyers in the crossbred market. So we had our usual suspects in there, China, but we didn't have tech wool in there supporting the top four.
And for next week, what's on offer?
Sydney, Melbourne and Fremantle, 26,000 bales or just a tad over, so extremely limited quantity. I think Fremantle's roughly 2,500 bales. It'll be a one-day sale on a Tuesday. So again, supply is the issue. Extremely tight as we go into next week.
Thank you, Danny. Time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.